Are you a city person to the core, or where are your roots?
I grew up about 30 miles away from here in suburban Long Island, So which was very different than growing up in the city. But the city was very much a part of, our my childhood. It was, I had the kind of parents who brought us to museums, to music, to, whatever was age appropriate for us. And as we got older, to theater. My dad worked in Manhattan. So it was, it was the cultural background for my growing up.
It's rich in that, certainly. I'm a country girl at heart, but I think everybody should go to New York City at least once in their life. It's like a different planet.
It really is, and I must say that the time I spend outside the city, and I do spend a lot, I teach outside of the city, I've had long-time residencies in Vermont, and there's a part of me that could live outside of the city very easily. I couldn't have done it when I was younger. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I really needed to be in the city. Now, not so much.
I think you speak for many that way. Yeah, it's when we're young, we love that hustle and bustle and activity all the time. And as we get older, we tend to appreciate silence and slowness.
Yeah. I want the quiet. I really love quiet. On the other hand, I think this is an awesome place to grow older. I see a lot of people who thought they would retire out to the country, and they stay because it's so accessible and there's so much going on and you don't have to own a car. And, it's got its advantages and disadvantages just like everywhere.
Exactly. Is the city what keeps you motivated and inspires you? Is it a muse to you as you write?
I don't think so, especially. I think that what the city does is... it enriches me in the sense, so I don't know that it inspires me, but it enriches me because there's just so much going on. And I feel like it's a collision of ideas all of the time. Mm. And there's the old and the new, and it really is a city of immigrants, but there are people who have lived here forever. And it's rich in cultural life, and that does inspire me. It really does. And not so much, as a reader, I can read anywhere, and, there are a billion readings in the city all the time, but what really enriches me is the cultural life of things that I can't do. I am not a visual artist at all, and so I love to look at art. I love to go to galleries, and I love to go to museums. I love music, and there's so much live music here of such tremendous quality, whether it's ranging from, dark, dingy clubs where you can hear jazz and whatever, rock, something folky stuff, to, there's chamber music, there's the symphony, there's the opera, there's the everything, and there are all the people who are making that. I mean, just in my building, there's a guy who plays classical cello. There's a guy who does, world music. He plays every string instrument and, flute and everything in the world. And there's a guy who plays trombone. And those are just the people I know. Mm. And so sometimes I'm standing outside and there's John playing his mandolin. He's a world-class mandolin player. So, I don't have to search. I don't have to search hard.
That's
true. Nice.
Yeah.
And so I really, it's not weird to be a writer here.
It is elsewhere.
A writer. Yeah, I think it is. It is to be someone who loves to stay home and read or write or whatever. I think, when I was in high school, I had a group of friends and they were very artsy and interesting and we were political. We were very different than everyone else.
Yeah.
And then I went to college and I was not different. And I liked that. I went to Sarah Lawrence, which was big on the arts. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something really lovely about not being unusual.
Yeah,
It's that sort of adolescent pull towards fitting in, being understood, not having to explain yourself all the time. Which is not to say that all of my friends are artists. They're really not. But it's, they do everything. I love living here. Let's put it, the bottom line
I
is
hear that.
I love living here.
Yeah.
And I love visiting and staying for long stretches in other places.
So you're an alumna of Sarah Lawrence College, but now you're a director of the Writing Center there. So you've kind of gone full circle.
Yeah, I have. After I graduated college, I had a different life. I worked on photography magazines, and I did writing, and I worked in photography for a long time. And then I went to graduate school, and somebody invited me to go to graduate school at Sarah Lawrence. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And so I did. And I just, I changed my life. And at that point, I never left. But I was ready. You know, I was ready to do it and ready to start all over again. I mean, doing that required me to do the hustle, do the teaching hustle, do the adjuncting hustle.
Yeah.
And it was okay. I mean, I worked hard and you know, I thought, well, here I am starting at the bottom of the ladder again. Oh, well, you know, just suck it up and do it, you know, just do it. And I did. It worked out really well. So I'm very lucky. I have a great job at a great place with great students and great colleagues, mostly. Except when they're not.
I hear you.
Right?
But right, right.
And a really big writing department. So I'm surrounded by lovely, interesting, accomplished writers who are just, you know, people who are trying to get the work done and not drive home in traffic.
Well, now you're one of those accomplished writers. Congratulations. You've won quite a bit of critical acclaim here for your first novel, Barren Island, which is just so richly written and such a wide scope. So I came away just really admiring you and understanding how you've gotten these awards. You've gotten the 2015 AWP Association of Writers and Programs Prize, long-listed for the National Book Award, and there's others.
Yeah, that wasn't too shabby.
No, not at all. So over here at Western Michigan University, our new issue's Poetry and Prose is standing up and applauding, very proud of you.
Well, and I'm proud of them. They are really nice people. A shout out to Kim Colby, who is just a special person. She's terrific. And everyone who comes through helping her, the graduate students. I mean, Sarah Kidd was a graduate student who copy edited this thing and proofread it. Man, she's got like the laser eyes. You know, the laser
That's the
gaze.
Copy I got to read, Carol. They gave me one with like a zillion post-it notes on there, which actually I prefer. It was fun to see. And yeah, she does have a laser eye.
Right? Whoa. She was great. She was great. And it was fun explaining to her what were figures of speech that are particular to New York that wouldn't make sense elsewhere. You know, the syntax would be awkward, but fitting to the time and place. So that was fun. We had a good time. So it was a pleasure working with them, an absolute pleasure.
Give our listeners a synopsis, because it's almost hard to start. Like I said, it covers such a wide scope, so many important historical events that you've gone into in here. Tell our listeners, what is Barren Island about?
Barren Island takes place on a fictional island in Jamaica Bay, which your listeners may know of because Kennedy Airport is at Jamaica Bay, so they might have passed through. And for many years, until the 1930s, the actual Barren Island was the site of an industrial plant that was used for rendering glue and grease from the animals that lived in New York. This was primarily horses. Before the combustion engine, before everybody had trucks and cars, everything was moved around in New York by horse and by barge. And those were work animals that did not live long. And so this story takes place on a fictional version of that island. It's very close to Brooklyn. It's very close to Manhattan. Yet the people who work there often never went to Manhattan or Brooklyn. They lived their entire lives there. They were given housing. Their families lived there. Mm-hmm. There was a schoolhouse for children. And I wondered what it might be like to live there. And the island was finally closed down in the late 30s. And so I set my story with the bookends of 1929 to 1939, which is the stock market crash,
right,
and in 1929, and the beginning of World War II in September of 1939. So it was it really covers the Depression era,
mm-hmm,
and when the world is in turmoil. And I wondered what it would be like for these people living on this island, so close to one of the greatest cities in the world, one of the, you know, an international city, yet at arm's length from all that was going on. So it's sort of a small town existence in the shadows of an enormous world-class city.
Yeah.
And how they would deal with their actual small town lives, yet deal with the larger issues of the day that could not be avoided. And most of these people were immigrants. Most, not all, were immigrants. There was a small African-American population, and they, of course, were not immigrants. Their ancestors were brought here as slaves.
Right.
And how they dealt with the issues such as the stock market crash, racism, abortion, the festering fascism in Europe, labor struggles because they were trying to unionize. So all of these issues found their way to this little spit of land that was a factory site. It's so hard to say what it's about, in, you know, without either summarizing
a little bit of everything. I mean, it's huge. It's history, and yet I found, sometimes uncomfortably so, that it echoes in some of the issues we're going through today, whether it's well, starting with immigration, but there was, for instance, on page 380, there was this man, Fritz Kuhn, and he stands in front of a crowd calling white Gentiles the true patriots. And then you say something about, you know, he could run for office and get elected and nobody would stop him. You know, and there were areas like that in the book where it's going,
oh, geez.
Yeah.
Really. And I'm glad you pointed that out, because I finished this book a few years ago when our political platform felt very different. At least to me, it was a wonderful period of progress and progressive politics.
Right.
And I would have never anticipated what's happening now, although I always knew it was possible.
Yeah.
So
is history cyclical?
It is.
We're just kind of doomed to repeat ourselves?
I don't know that we're doomed to repeat ourselves, but I just know that even when things are surprising, and I certainly was surprised by the outcome last year, moral evolution is a really slow, tricky thing. And you know, sort of reminds me of my students. They all come to college. They're all around 18 years old. And they change over the years in terms of what they're savvy about,
mm-hmm,
but in terms of ethical questions, moral depth, so forth, they're starting from where an 18-year-old starts. They have some stuff, but they're not fully developed.
Yeah.
And every year we have to discuss certain issues again and again and again. So people are born. They have to figure out the same things again and again, and we have certain characteristics that don't go away. They're part of human nature, and I don't know why. That's certainly out of the realm of my understanding, but I certainly see it, so that when I see pictures of a white nationalist in Charlottesville, they look no different to me, and they speak no differently than Fritz Kuhn.
Exactly.
You know, they put on a tie and a jacket,
mm-hmm,
and they cut their hair nicely, and they speak at loud volume, and they stir up a fear in people that wasn't even there. But it's easy to be frightened. You know, there's lots of stuff that scares me, but if somebody would try to work me into a frenzy, they probably could not. But there are people who can be worked into a frenzy, or people who are willing to shut their eyes to the disgraceful things happening in front of them,
mm-hmm,
because it would serve them. They think it serves them well. So an example would be, right now we're in the middle of this Harvey Weinstein,
right,
you know, episode, and people are outraged about sexual abuse and sexual assault. Yet so many women voted for for someone who bragged about sexual assault.
Yeah.
And were willing to tolerate it because they thought that there were other things that would be in their best interest. And I just don't see the world that way. I think if somebody is that rotten about something, eventually they're going to be rotten to you about something. And how do you tolerate that? So that the things that people in Barren Island were dealing with are technologically different, but fundamentally the same. How do you make a life? How do you make an authentic life? How do you have family that you can be close to and look out for and protect from the dangers? And you can't really protect them from danger. Things will happen. Horrible things will happen. How do you respond to that? How do you have work that for which you are decently compensated and not unnecessarily put in danger when you're working? How are you not taken advantage of? How can you make people feel welcome in strange circumstances? How do you bridge cultural gaps? It's all the same.
Yeah.
That's the same whether it's today or it's 1,000 years ago.
That's probably what struck me most in reading Barren Island is it's long ago and yet it's today.
And those are the kinds of questions that interest me. I'm interested in the place of the individual in history.
Yeah.
So how these individuals, they didn't choose to be born at the time they were born, but there they are. And, you know, what would you do if you were born in a certain time? How would you respond? How would you act? Would you be the same person as you are today? Or would circumstances make you somehow different? I always wonder, what would I do if I was in that situation? You know, what would I do if I was in Charlottesville this summer? You know, how would I have responded? I can know how I vote and how I think and how I speak among my friends, but what would I do in a dangerous situation? And I've been in those situations. The first time I went to Austin, Texas, there was a Ku Klux Klan march, and I'd never seen such a thing.
Mm.
And I went with my friends as counter-protesters, and I was scared. I was really, really scared. And I was younger, and I was scared. And I've certainly gone to lots of protests in New York, and I'm gay, so I've gone to gay rights marches and rallies and have certainly felt threatened there, but not so much anymore. And I'm in this cozy cushion of New York where everything bad that can happen happens, but everything good that can happen happens. And there are lots of people to be surrounded by, you know. So it's not the lone voice calling out in the darkness. So I don't have to have the kind of courage that people elsewhere have to have in order to take to the street.
Well, speaking of courage and some of the dangers that we've had to face, now, I wondered if that had an influence on your choosing the subject matter for your novel, or if you thought about them as you were writing. You had four grandparents who were Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe, who also worked in garment factories. And you've lost family members to the Holocaust. Did you think about them as you were writing? Do they inspire you in any way?
Yes, I did think about them. This is not their story.
Right.
They didn't live on this island. They didn't do this kind of work. They had very different lives than the people described here. But I did think about them. You know, they were born in a different century. They were born at the very tail end of the 19th century. And that immigrant experience, I've always been in awe of people who pick up, pack up, and go. One of my grandparents came very young with her parents. My maternal grandmother came here when she, I think, was about 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And she came with her parents and a grandmother. So she did not make that choice. She did not come. She was educated in America, you know. But my other grandparents came as teenagers, and they came alone and were sent by family or left to because they couldn't earn a living. There were just no opportunities for them, and politically things were very difficult. World War I was beginning to kick up. So those nations were unstable, or that region was unstable. You know, the Hungarian Austrian Empire, that doesn't exist anymore, but it existed. The Russian Empire, all that turmoil. Mm-hmm. And certainly for young Jewish men, if they were drafted into the Russian army, they were never seen again. They were the war fodder.
Yeah.
Just as in this country, we use the poorest of our people as war fodder.
Yeah.
They get the worst assignments there in the infantry. So people were leaving. They were, you know, it was not a good place to live. And I can't, you know, I have a grandfather who came here when he was 16 on a boat alone. I think, really? You know, you did that? You slept outdoors? You know, whoa. You know, at 16, I was a pain in the neck living with my parents, being stubborn, not figuring out how to survive that kind of thing. I had to survive other issues. But so I admire people who make that leap. I know other people fear them and resent them. Not me.
Yeah.
I really admire it. It's something I would find very difficult to do. I don't like to move.
Well, especially such a huge cultural move as well as geographical. You can't just go home on a weekend.
That's right. And, you know, young people now, my students, they're on the phone with their parents all the time. They Skype.
Right.
You know, a very dear friend of ours moved to New Zealand a few years ago. I Skype with him every Friday afternoon. Mm. It's his Saturday. So that when I see him, he comes to New York once a year, it's not like I haven't seen him. I never look for physical changes. I see him.
Yeah.
We have coffee on Friday afternoons.
Yeah.
You know, it's breakfast. It's coffee for me. It's breakfast for him. So people really did leave and never see their families again. They wrote if they were literate or they paid someone to write for them. But they never heard the voices of their parents again or other family and friends.
Yeah.
They really, it was a huge transition. And it wasn't always easy. And they didn't have wonderful jobs waiting for them. But it was less bad than where they were living. And they struggled. But it didn't mean their lives were all about struggle. They weren't solely defined by those struggles. They also had joy and love and the loss of love and everything else that is what makes a life.
I was going to ask you if writing this book taught you any lessons as you were working your way through it, but I think you maybe just answered all of that, or what you want your readers to come away with. Perhaps it is that way of looking at immigrants.
Yeah, it is. And then you have a life,
mm-hmm.
however it is, and you do what you can. I'm not saying the best that you can. You do what you can with the circumstances that you're given, and try, and you keep trying.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the hardest thing for me to realize, there's something that I had to do, and I don't know if this is giving away too much or it doesn't matter. You know, I can never figure it. I always tease people that, you know, with a really interesting book, it doesn't matter if they give away a plot point. So, for example, I have no problem telling people that Anna Karenina jumps in front of a train. You know, guess what? She jumps in front of a train.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's important in the novel, but it's still, you read the novel. But when I started writing it, the opening line is ask about the smell. I wasn't quite sure who I was instructing or who was being instructed to ask about the smell.
Mm.
It was anyone, you know, it was the reader. It was, and as I got further into it, I realized who or what I was addressing, and that became a struggle for me, and I ended up going back through the entire novel. It's not something that people notice, but when Marta, the protagonist, speaks,
mm-hmm.
not to her contemporaries, but when she speaks to this listener who she's addressing, she never speaks in contractions. She always speaks in full words. Her voice is very formal.
Yeah.
And I went back through all 400 pages and took out all those contractions because of the end of the novel. Do you have it nearby at hand?
I do.
Okay, so you know how at the very end of the novel, and some people by that point are exhausted and don't even, you know, they're like, okay, let me never see a dead horse again. It stinks.
Yeah.
at the very end, she says, "As for you, ask what you want. Had you been there the way you were supposed to be everywhere, I would not be telling this now. You would know." I struggle with the idea of God.
Doesn't everyone?
I hope so. I hope that it's not something that they don't struggle with.
I think we're supposed to.
And I don't believe in an intervening God. But at the end, when she said, "Had you been there the way you are supposed to be everywhere, I would not be telling this now. You would know." So she, Marta, is 80 years old and doesn't know, isn't settled yet on the question of God.
Yeah.
Yet she's speaking to God, but doesn't believe in God, because if God is everywhere, you don't need to tell God the story. You know, God would know.
Yeah.
So I like that other layer, because for me it's a way of wrestling with the question of existence and significance. Do we matter? Does any of this matter? I think in the overall scheme of things, we don't matter, and none of this matters. But since we're here, we should do good. We should make it good. We should do right by one another.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is an extraordinary thing. I don't know how it happened. I don't understand it. I find it fascinating. But in my next novel, the novel I'm working on now, has a physicist as one of the central characters.
Mm.
But I don't know. So I love the fact that she is telling this story to a listener that may or may not exist, but feels compelled to tell it anyway. It's a part of the book that still hits me in the heart when I read it.
You know you've done a good job then, if it does that and it continues to do that. It's alive outside of you.
It took me a while to write this. It took me 7 years. I worked very hard on it.
Mm.
And I'm glad that other people find it so moving and engaging. Because I wouldn't know. You know, and when I was writing it, I never showed it to anyone until I was done. I showed a friend who's not a writer. I showed her the beginning.
Yeah.
Because she's a very dear friend, and I kind of show her everything, but you know, or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I just so she knew what I was up to, but I didn't show it to any of my writer friends until I didn't have another question, until I didn't know, until I was done. I just was done. And they both made a similar comment. They're very different kinds of writers. And I thought, okay, I can do that. I can address that. And I did, and to the satisfaction of both of them. And then that was it. So it was a very isolating process. You know, my friends used to tease, "What are you doing in there? What are you doing in there?" They thought I was playing Scrabble or something. I don't know.
Well, now we know.
Yeah, now we know what I was doing in there.
It's a beautiful book. I hope our listeners will all look for it and pick it up. It's readily available here in the Kalamazoo area.
I bet it
is. Well, thank you so much, Carol.
It's been a football team.
Yeah, there you go. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
And likewise.